With the Marketplace Morning Report in Austin, Texas, I'm Andy Euler in for David Brancaccio. More than 20 years ago, conservative political commentator David Brooks wrote about America's creative class of politically progressive knowledge workers in a book called Bobos in Paradise. He said this class, which some call the cultural elite, was basically open to whomever wanted to join. 2 decades later, Brooks says that thinking was naive, and he recently revised some of those thoughts for The Atlantic. He joins me now to discuss. David, thanks for being here.
Good to be with you.
In the article, you re-examine this group of people that you wrote about back in 2000 in the book Bobos in Paradise. You call it the creative class. First of all, I need you to sort of give us the idea of what a Bobo is.
A Bobo is a bourgeois bohemian. So those are people with 60s values and 90s money. So there were people like Steve Jobs who wanted to be a big corporate executive but wanted to wear black t-shirts. Apple's big ad campaign was the rebels, the misfits. So suddenly a multinational corporation was aligning itself with poets like Allen Ginsberg. And so those are people who made money because they were really good with ideas and words. But they didn't want to be corporate sellouts, so they had to devise a whole new consumptuary style of spending their money. So they created a style where you could, spending money on a chandelier would be vulgar, but $20,000 for an Aga stove just showed you were a foodie, and that was good.
You wrote about this 20 years ago, and then you decided to sort of revisit the concept now. What spurred the idea of, you know what, I need to sort of rethink? Because you admitted that some of the stuff that you wrote 20 years ago isn't the case these days, right?
Yeah, I thought it was sort of a cool class to be a part of, which I was. You go into some Stanford or Wayne, Pennsylvania, where I went to high school, or Winnetka, Illinois, some upscale suburbs, and suddenly there's thick organic bread. And so that seemed kind of cool to me, and we made life a little more interesting. The food of the Protestant establishment was really bad. They had what somebody called a horniness for the ugly in their fashion style. So I thought we were making life more diverse, more interesting. 20 years on, the people who made money by trading ideas, first of all, we all moved to big cities like Denver and Chicago and San Francisco. Second, we concentrated power and married each other. Third, we invested huge amounts of money in our kids, so they came to dominate the competitive schools that produced us. And so before long, we had formed a sort of an elite Brahmin class that was driving the rest of the country crazy.
So throughout the piece, you talk about the Bobos, but you use the pronoun we. You include yourself in this group, and I'm probably a part of this group too. I'm curious, was there a moment where you understood or decided that, you know what, I'm talking in the we form here?
It's pretty hard to ignore. My parents were college professors. I went to the University of Chicago, grew up in suburban Philadelphia in New York City. I've been working for 20 years at the New York Times. So when you fit a stereotype as well as I do, you got to confess to it.
Now, one of the points you made 20 years ago was that theoretically you could join this creative class if you had the right degree, if you had the right job, things like that. Is this not true anymore?
That's not true. You know, the top 60 schools, some of them have more people from the top 1% of earners than from the bottom 60%. You know, upper middle class college educated folks invest, for example, $5,000 per kid just in extracurricular activities. So their kids just have huge advantages when it comes to applying to these schools. And so we have not made the society more equal. We've made it more unequal. And not only is there a class division around education, there's this income division as we concentrate in the really affluent cities. And then there's sort of a status and social inequality. So people in the media, in the academy, in the big nonprofits, if you're not seen by us, you feel unseen by society. You feel like you're in flyover country or you feel neglected. And hence we have Trump. And if you tell people they're invisible, they're going to react really badly. And I should say not just in the U.S., in every Western country this has happened.
And also in places like Hungary, right? I mean, this is taking over different places. You're right. It's not just America.
Yeah, it's weird. Vladimir Putin just gave a speech about wokeness. Like, why does he care about wokeness? But they all have learned to do the culture war game to attack what they call the creative class. In Britain, for example, the Tory party, the conservative party, used to be the party of the landed aristocracy. Now it's the party of the working class. So you've had these big changes in politics as sort of the reaction against the urban, affluent, highly educated folks.
It sounds like what you're telling me is that education plays a big role in perpetuating this sort of class structure that we have today, yeah?
Yeah, basically the SATs came into being in the 1950s, or their importance, because people at Harvard in the 1950s decided we can't just be Ivy League schools for a bunch of blue blood males. We have to diversify. And so at first, going to GPAs and SATs, that was an attempt to democratize education. And it worked for a golden generation. And then it stopped working. Then it just became a way to lock in your advantages as affluent families. It's just crazy, frankly, that we divide young people on the basis of how they do in high school tests and SAT scores between the ages of 15 and 25. It's just crazy that the skills that make you good at a McKinsey consultant are more valued than the skills that make you a good home health nurse. And so I would say the criteria of our meritocracy, nobody would devise that criteria now. We hopefully have a much broader view of what constitutes human excellence and the diversity of human people. But we settled on this narrow criteria, and now we're kind of stuck with it because of the U.S. News and World Report rankings.
You talk about that there's a sense, this economic and social ease that's a characteristic of a Bobo, right? And on the surface, that situational and social ease, it sounds like a good thing. It sounds like, you know, if you can talk to, I think your illustration is, you can talk to the cafeteria worker while at the same time sort of maintaining your distance and understanding where to then talk about, you know, that hip new band that you saw at a club. You know, there's something nice about having that ease, but at the same time, you say it can have negative consequences.
Yeah, it's a subtle form of stratification. Even the ability to read a hip club or the ability to read an organic grocery store, that requires growing up in a certain sort of family with a certain sort of knowledge. You know, I'm a college teacher, and I would say my students have done well. They've thrived in the system, and they're phenomenally good at going up to their professors and pretending we're sort of buddy-buddy, but at the same time, they're extremely deferential. And that's just a social skill that you can't get by reading about it in books. You had to have gone to the sort of school where there's office hours and where you learn to sort of subtly flatter and subtly suck up to your professors without being too obvious about it. And that's a skill that only exists by being in certain schools, existing in certain quarters, and having been trained by your parents in certain ways.
You write that the Bobos have this stranglehold on the economy. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, one of the things we've done is we've congregated in cities. It used to be companies, you know, Lowe's Hardware had headquarters in Wilkes, North Carolina, and the banks, you had your local bank in your mid-sized Tennessee city. But as corporations have concentrated in cities, you get this concentration of wealth, and this happens in the U.S., but pretty much every Western country. And so other places naturally feel left out because the concentration of wealth is enormous. And so the parties who represent the more rural parts of these Western countries, they say, see, they've concentrated the wealth, they've built up social status, they hate us, and let's go on the assault. And that, I think, is a large part of Donald Trump, Viktor Orban, Boris Johnson, Marine Le Pen, et cetera, et cetera.
It's interesting, too, because exactly what you're talking about, this was a shift because 50, 60 years ago, it was different parties sort of enacting, I guess, the same sort of mentality, right?
Yeah, I mean, the Republican Party, like the British Conservative Party, that was the party of the corporate establishment. And there still are a lot of rich Republicans, God knows. But they tell me when I interview them, they feel beleaguered, they feel looked down upon. And then there's an important distinction to be drawn between those families who have their money tied up in properties, a factory for furniture or orchards or a bunch of Bojangles kitchen franchises. Those people tend to be spread around the country, and that's one kind of wealth, and those are people of great wealth. Then there are people who work on finance. There are people who work in VC. There are people who work in tech. Those people are much more highly mobile. They have different sources of wealth. Their sources of wealth exist because they were able to thrive in the educational system and get jobs in places like Google. And so they have tended to go blue, while the older forms of wealth have tended to go red.
I'm curious, too, you talk about sort of the megaphone with which, you know, you have to some extent, and a lot of folks in the media have. You know, I'm curious, who are you talking to? Who are you trying to reach when you're writing this? Or is it just sort of a, hey, this is what's going on?
Well, usually you're just trying to figure out, this is what's going on. I'm not trying to solve the world's problems, just describe the world so we can understand it a little better. But I do think it's incumbent on members of our class to know when we're being, well, insufferable, and know the way we're coming off to other people, and when we're trying to impose our values on people without really even stopping to hear what their values are. I mean, I'm no better than anybody else. In 2015, I wrote about 15 columns for the New York Times saying, don't worry, Donald Trump will never get the Republican nomination. And so I was completely wrong. And well, I was living in Washington, working for the New York Times, teaching at Yale. So I was on the Acela basically my whole life. How could I be out of touch with America, you know? And so I spent the ensuing 5 or 6 years, hopefully, widening my horizons and going to 35 or 40 states every year just to try to be a better citizen or at least a better journalist. And once you go there, you find how much resentment and how hard it is to walk into the room with the cultural baggage that I carry and how hard you have to work for them to even let you ask them questions. And so that's something I've struggled with the last 5 years, but I hope to my benefit.
I'm just curious about sort of the community that you talk about. We sort of, in the elite class, I think, to some extent look down upon folks who don't prize that individualism. At the same time, it's those communities that they're working for each other and they have sort of a common good. And we, it doesn't feel like have a whole lot of that in the big cities. Is that fair?
There are some cultural differences. One, the higher up you go, the income scale, and this is both for Republicans and Democrats, the more individualistic people are. People down the income scale, both red and blue, have to look after each other. So they've got a much more of a code of mutual dependency. We have the assumption, almost in my class at least, that kids will go away to college. They'll leave home. That's not an assumption that's widespread in large parts of the country, that people want to go to college. But, you know, your home is your place. And there's much more attachment to the somewhere where you happen to be. And so there are subtle cultural differences that have grown up as we've entered different worlds, different ways we talk about our faith and things like that. I will say, as a journalist, and I would say this is true for anybody, you go out, you find yourself in West Virginia, you find yourself in McCook, Nebraska, where I was recently, and you start asking questions. Three questions in, people are happy to talk. In my whole career, I've almost never met anybody who was not really eager to talk about their life. And they'll say, oh, you just regard us as flyover country. And then three questions in, you're in a good conversation. And you're hearing a story. And so it's amazing. We draw stereotypes of each other. It's amazing how quickly we drop stereotypes once we start asking questions.
You talk about sort of, for all its openness, the creative class is remarkably insular. Does it dictate a cultural shift? Because you're right, there's this idea of being more open, you know, open borders, open trade, things like that. But at the end of the day, it's pretty damn insular, right?
Well, you know, I think people don't often know how they're coming across. I think in last summer, people didn't know how defund the police would sound to a lot of people. Even now that, you know, even the way people talk about race, you know, I'm all for talking about systemic racism and racial structures that have marred our history. But sometimes when people say you have to confess your whiteness, that comes across to a lot of poor whites as, what privilege do I have exactly? And so suddenly you get a bad reaction. And this is not to defend Trump voters and Donald Trump, Lord knows. If you treat people with disrespect, they will act badly. And frankly, in a lot of the places where I work, there are very few Trump voters. And the message they've received is our voices aren't being worth heard. And they've reacted very badly to it, not only rejecting what they call the mainstream media, but the whole cognitive enterprise of science. And so this is not to defend, it's just to sort of try to understand the circumstance that led to this deformation.
Hmm. It sounded like in the article you were giving at least a little bit of praise to the Biden agenda. Is there something that can be done in Washington to reduce just how insular this elite class is?
I'm hopeful. Joe Biden is the unique creature in that he did not come from the creative class. He's the first president since Ronald Reagan who does not have an Ivy League degree. Condescension is alien to his nature. You know, his home is Scranton. And so he really is more formed by a working class community than by the educational system. And so just as a cultural signal, I think he sends an egalitarian message. Second, the Biden agenda, if the last 40 years have been a giant funnel directing money to highly educated people in the cities, it seems to me the Biden agenda is a giant funnel directing money away from the cities toward less educated people all around the country of all races and varieties. And so I've generally been on the right in this country, but given the circumstances of widening social and economic inequality, I think shifting a large amounts of money through a child tax credit, through education vouchers, through infrastructure jobs, that's A, may ease some of the inequality, and B, is just a sign of respect that we've seen what's happened to you over the last 40 years, and we're going to try to do something about it.
Now, this is not all that positive of a portrait that you're painting in this article. You're worried about what you see. Where do we go from here? What do you think?
Well, I do think some sort of economic redistribution is part of it. But the second thing, you know, there's just no other choice when there is cultural gaps opening up, whether in a conflict zone or what our country, which has turned into a conflict zone, it's contact. There was a guy named Gordon Allport decades ago who had a theory, contact theory, that if you bring people together and they actually get to know one another, then a lot of the stereotypes, a lot of bitterness will fall away. A lot of people vastly overestimate how much the people on the other side hate them. There's an industry of people whose job it is to exaggerate how much people on the other side hate them. And once you actually make contact, then a lot of that fades away. One quick story. I was in South Dakota interviewing a guy who was like 70. And he said, let me tell you about the best day of my life. I was a foreman in a plant. They replaced the technology. I could no longer be a foreman in the plant. So they laid me off. I wanted to slip out of there silently. So I packed up my stuff in my office in a box. I opened the door and I was going to walk out to my car. There were 3,500 people forming a double line between my office door and my car door in the parking lot. And I walked down that line with them applauding and me cheering me all the way along. And he said, that was 35 years ago. That was the best day of my life. And I voted for Donald Trump because every job I've had since has been worse and worse. And my family is suffering and my community is suffering. So when you hear that story, you've got a much richer vein to tap into. When you see the Trump nonsense and when you see stuff I regard as morally abhorrent, you are more likely to think Trump and such movements are the wrong answer to the right question. And at least there's a human face on it. And I think this, you know, we all go home to, and we all have members of our family who are on the other side of the political divide. Somehow hammering through that is somehow an essential cultural task, aside from all the economic and political things that have to happen.
You're talking about a sort of class warfare. How does it end, or does it end? I mean, is that what you're sort of hopeful about, I guess?
Yeah, well, we could have a civil war and crack up, but I'm hoping that's not the case. You know, I think we've gone through in this country moments of moral convulsion when people were disgusted with establishment power and when new moral crusades came on the scene, a new generation demanding changes. I think we're in the middle of that right now. But, you know, we were in one of those moral convulsions in the 1960s. We were in the 1890s with the Progressive Era. We were in the 1830s with Jackson. So we get through them, but culture changes. It becomes a very different culture. And I think what's happening in America, we had 60 years of individualism, of really hyper-individualism, left a lot of people behind, left a lot of people feeling lonely, left a lot of people feeling unseen. And now we're having an argument about what kind of group, what sort of communities do we want to be? And there are different versions of what community should look like, but we're all fumbling toward versions of community so we can feel belonging again. And that's a messy process, but I'm hopeful that we get through it the way we have previous times in American history.
David Brooks is a columnist for The New York Times and a contributing writer for The Atlantic. His latest piece for The Atlantic is called How the Bobos Broke America. David, thanks again for doing this.
Sure, it's been a pleasure.